Today is Tuesday, January 31st, 2023. This is part four of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Frank Barrios. And Frank spells his last name B-A-R-R-I-O-S. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Frank. How are you today?
Good morning. Doing well.
Good. Glad to hear it. Frank, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you do.
Thank you so much. The end of part three, you had told us about an amazing opportunity you had to go to Kuala Lumpur for the Bureau of Reclamation to help with a project over there, and you had a very creative idea on how to get back to Phoenix from there. Can you pick that story up?
Yeah, no. Malaysia is pretty close to halfway around the world, and rather than the shortest route back to Phoenix would have been through New York then down to Phoenix, but I decided to take 1 month annual leave and go the other direction, which had brought me through California back to Phoenix, okay. Which is a little bit longer, and so I paid the difference, which was like $300 and some, and went that direction back to Phoenix.
And where did you go on that journey? Where did you stop along the way?
Well, it started in Singapore. I visited Singapore, a beautiful city, and then I wanted to go to Israel.
Okay.
To see all of the holy sites, and to get to Israel from Singapore, you had to go to Iran.
And Iran, really? You couldn't? Israel. There was no direct? Huh, fascinating.
No. This was back in the 70s.
Okay.
Late, and there was a lot of turmoil going on between the Israelis and the Muslims. And so I took the plane. I had to change planes in Iran. And, oh, Lord, I had a diplomatic passport, but it didn't, well, it did help a lot. I talked to one guy there that said that he had been frisked with two Israelis holding a machine gun on him. and then, so I got my ticket from Iran to Israel, to Tel Aviv, and then I had to be frisked. My diplomatic passport didn't save me from that. And then they had a bus that they would put you on and take you out into a plane sitting out in the middle of the airfield, completely surrounded by Israelis holding machine guns. So,
well, surrounded by Iranians or Israelis holding machine guns?
No, those were Israelis. They evidently were afraid to be sabotaged by Muslims.
Got it. Okay.
And so I got in the plane, went to Tel Aviv, and from there I took all of these stories, I took every chance I had, all the tourist sites that I probably would never see again, which, of course, was Jerusalem, and then the Dead Sea, Masada, and and then from there, I went to Greece, did the same thing there. I think the capital of Greece is Athens, if I remember right.
That's right.
I spent several days there and went to all the sites where...
up to the Acropolis and...
I went through the Acropolis and through Troy is there also, from there, I went to Italy, and of course, I'm Catholic, so I had to visit the Vatican, and and I went to Pompeii. I went to what's the other one? Where Mario Lanza came from, or one of the big singers, turn of the century. But anyway, I took all those tours, and there, from there, I was getting short on time, but I skipped France. I changed planes in Paris and then went to Spain. and Madrid, and there took all the sites, including the grave of Franco and some other things. And from there, I went to England and Stonehenge and all the sites that you, tourist sites in England. And then I got on the plane, went back to Phoenix, and continued working there in Phoenix.
What was your biggest takeaway from that month-long return around the world? Of course, you realize now with a huge list of places that you said you visited, no way near enough time to really...
Well,
you know.
The most impressive was Israel.
Okay.
If you're a Christian and you read the death of Christ, to see the actual location where he was crucified and
yeah.
see the tomb, it's pretty impressive. And then Masada was very, very impressive. It's a fortress on top of a hill that the Jews fought the Romans from and lost, but it was impressive. And the Dead Sea, all of that was probably the biggest. But then the others were also impressive. And of course, the trip to Iran, I didn't mention it, but you had a lot of people screaming, carrying on everywhere you went there. I had to change airports. I didn't visit Iran. What I did was I got off my plane and I had to go to another airport to get to Israel.
Okay.
So I was able to, I had to go through screaming crowds of mainly women that were upset about something.
This was after the fall of the Shah, wasn't it? Or right about that time?
That's correct. Right about that time.
Okay.
So this was, I think the Shah had was in New York getting treatment for cancer or something. And so it was during that time. Well, letting you know, I think the Shah would have been the only leader that would have allowed planes to go from Iran to Israel.
Right, right. Fascinating.
And Singapore was impressive too. It was a modern city.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the others, I'd read so much about it, and I visited Troy, where the Helen of Troy thing. But I visited in Spain. I could communicate, so it made a difference.
Oh, nice.
I speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure I did better in Spain with my Spanish than I did with my English in England.
Oh, that's cute. Hmm.
But I did Stonehenge with another fabulous visit. I'd heard so much about it and got a chance to see it.
And then it was back to Phoenix.
Correct. And at that point, I was looking at going the next step up. And the Bureau of Reclamation at that time, this was 75, by 75, I started looking for a promotion somewhere.
Okay.
But every promotion that was available with the Bureau of Reclamation was outside of Arizona. And if I wanted to get a promotion, I had to apply for a position outside of Arizona. And I think I applied for one, but my heart really wasn't in it. I wanted to stay in Arizona.
Hmm.
So a position opened up at the Arizona Water Commission, which was the state agency dealing with water for Arizona. And I applied for it, and they selected me.
Okay.
And what that position was, I would get a four-person planning team. And the legislature had passed legislation with money to hire that person and the crew. And what it was, Soil Conservation Service, which is a federal agency, provides flood protection for farmers at no cost to the state. It's paid for by the federal government.
Okay.
And what we could do in that program, but the Soil Conservation Service was very slow. They took forever to do anything.
Okay.
But if the state of Arizona could do the planning for that project and get it to the SCS quicker, then it could be built quicker.
Oh, okay.
So what they did is they paid for this planning team, of which I would be heading up, to put together flood control dikes to protect the CAP canal. And at the same time, they would be protecting farmland. So it would get paid for out of a different pot than the pot. The CAP had to be repaid by the taxpayer of Arizona. So this was a freebie for the Arizona taxpayer, other than federal taxes, of course. But but this, and there were two in particular that when the canal crossed that area, it would cross above a whole bunch of agricultural area that SCS had already been looking at protecting it from floods.
Okay.
One of them was the Harcahela Valley, just west of Phoenix, and the other was Queen Creek. And we expedited those planning studies. I had a geologist, an economist, an engineer, and what was the other one? I think that was it. Those were the three. I think it was four in total. And we did all of what was needed to put a report together, a planning report that would authorize construction of these dikes.
Okay.
Above the CAP canal, but they also would protect the land below them, which was farmland.
Okay.
Huge segments of the Harcahela Valley that was being farmed, and huge segments of Queen Creek that was being farmed that needed to be protected.
Were you still an employee of Reclamation at the time?
When I applied, yes, I was. Then they hired me, and then I went across. In fact, wasn't a big move because the state office was across the street from the bureau office.
But you were no longer working for Reclamation. Now you were working for the state of Arizona?
That's correct.
Okay.
And then I did that. We finished the project, did the two planning studies, and that went forward, saving the Arizona taxpayer quite a bit of money. Then they started reorganizing, the big event that occurred with the state was when Bruce Babbitt was governor, he decided to create the Department of Water Resources, which would be a full state agency versus the Arizona Water Commission.
Okay.
The Arizona Water Commission was headed by a board of directors of local important people locally. But now he dissolved the Water Commission and created the Department of Water Resources.
Okay.
Which was would be a state agency with the director reporting directly to the governor.
And the director would be appointed by the governor.
That's correct.
So as the governor, as the governor's changed office, there would be a new director, but the employees under the director would keep their jobs. Maybe.
But keep in mind that the head of the Arizona Water Commission was Wes Steiner, well known throughout the United States. He was he was a guru when it came to water, and Wes Steiner remained director. In fact, he was very close to Babbitt.
Okay.
And but he remained through several governors.
Oh,
nobody.
Wow.
Nobody would touch him because of his reputation. He was known throughout the West for his abilities in water, and that's why they hired him originally. They hired him away from California and brought him to Arizona, and he was heading the Water Commission and Wes Steiner. And in fact, he took some functions away from the State Land Department and gave them to the Department of Water Resources, which. There was a lot of animosity between the Wes Steiner and the director of the State Land Department at the time, but Wes was very, Babbitt felt that water was important and that he was going to put it right at the top of his agenda.
Okay.
And Wes Steiner would be his number two man.
What do you remember about Wes?
Wes was a tall World War II veteran. He served in World War II somewhere against Japan.
Okay.
But Wes was extremely, extremely, what's the word I want to use? He was very, very, you could not bribe Wes Steiner.
Okay.
He was about the most, almost, you could almost call him a monk, because Wes went overboard to always follow the law as much as he could.
Okay.
And it was very political, but like I said, he was known throughout the West. If you mentioned Wes Steiner in those days, every water director in the Southwest or in the West knew who Wes Steiner was. He was very well known, and the only drawback Wes had, he was not a good speaker.
Oh.
When he got up to speak, he would stutter, wouldn't carry a conversation really well, but it didn't matter to people. It was a time when the fact that he was honest and knew water and would do the right thing.
Okay.
And the big difference, I think one of the things is Wes would of course he was tied up with the politics of the time, but
mm-hmm.
Wes did things for the right reason, and he had enough push where I don't think there'd be many governors who would fire him in those days because he was so well known.
Okay.
And in fact, Wes continued being the head of the Department of Water Resources until he retired, and he retired sometime in the 90s or 80s, sometime in the 80s, I believe it was, he retired.
Okay, so you were a key point of this, a key part of the Arizona Water Commission. When Governor Babbitt dissolved that commission, did he move you into the Department of Water Resources?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
Mine was not a political position. Mine was an employee position.
As what role?
As the head of this planning group.
Oh, okay. So the planning group continued working with the Soil Conservation Service.
Well, but no, then everything changed.
Oh.
When Babbitt became governor. When Babbitt became governor, he created the Department of Water Resources. And the big emphasis at that time, and that restructured everything, was the creation of the Groundwater Management Code.
Okay.
And, what's her name? I can't think of her name right now, but parallel to creating what the Groundwater Code did was it created the Department of Water Resources in 1980-81, somewhere in there. And there was a group headed by a woman attorney. She's still here. And in fact, she's given a presentation to the Agribusiness Council. I saw that in the paper. And I can't think of her name. But she was the attorney that was doing all the legal work for Babbitt.
Okay.
And that restructured the entire frame of the Water Commission, where before they just didn't just become the Department of Water Resources. It created a whole new agency with different responsibilities. And out of that reorganization that occurred, I became chief of planning, flood control, and something else. Everything that wasn't under somebody got thrown into my division.
Okay.
And I ended up with about, I don't know, 15, 17 people under me.
All right.
And I was chief of planning and flood control. And by the way, in between the end of that other strut vein and the and the creation of this new group, I also was chief of flood control for a couple of years, which is what the state was doing. We had flooding going on throughout the state, and they were giving money to rural areas to protect themselves against flooding. And we did a benefit cost analysis to see if it was justified to give them the money to build a flood control structure for protection. We built a structure for Winslow, Arizona. We built several structures in Tucson. Most of what we looked at, we couldn't justify because the benefits had to be better than the cost of the structure.
Right.
But basically, the Department of Water Resources, everything got restructured around the groundwater code. And all of a sudden, we got an entire section of lawyers, too, to implement the groundwater code. Under this gal who had done the law, she came to work for us as the head of the legal department.
Okay.
And the big thing was under this law, and it was very controversial, we created what was called active management areas, where the state of Arizona would regulate groundwater use in certain areas. And the areas were Prescott area, Phoenix area, the Casa Grande and farming areas, and Pima County, which would include Tucson and its farming area.
Okay.
It also created several what they call irrigation non-expansion areas, which wasn't as strict as the active management area, but did not allow new agriculture to come into the area. If they were, and this was only on groundwater. We had no control or power over surface water or CAP. This is just groundwater.
Okay.
Well, of course, the mines, the cities, farmers, they're not about to agree to allow the state to come in and regulate them. So Babbitt had an uphill battle to try to get this passed. And many people suspect, and I think this is the truth, Babbitt went to the Bureau of Reclamation, they were about to start the construction of the CAP, and he told them, threaten those people in Phoenix, in Arizona, that you won't build a CAP unless they pass a law to regulate their groundwater. That's exactly what the Bureau did. They came in and said, if you don't pass this law, we don't build the CAP. And these people, the farmers, mines, the cities, all knew they had no future without the CAP.
Interesting.
And they basically were up against a brick wall. Either they helped pass the groundwater law, or they're out of business in a few years here in Arizona.
And this would have been in the late 70s this was happening?
No, this was the law passed in 1981.
Okay, thank you.
Or 80, I think it passed in 1980.
Okay.
So the late 70s was when these negotiations were going on.
Got it.
And they reluctantly agreed to the groundwater code and it passed. But no, it was only in those areas that I mentioned. The rest of the state was not regulated for groundwater use. They could do anything they wanted.
Okay.
And that's the way it is today.
Right.
This was the thing created an active management areas in the central, basically in the areas where, except for the Prescott area, where the CAP water would go.
Got it. Okay.
The idea was the CAP would replace your groundwater use. You'd quit pumping. CAP would provide you the water you need, and then the groundwater could, over the years, start building back up again.
Okay. So this makes... This is why I've been seeing... Well, in Mojave County...
No rules at all.
No rules at all. Okay, and we have huge groundwater pumping and giant radial farmland, all kinds of alfalfa growing in hot desert with very little rainfall.
Money
Got it.
Money's talking, not common sense.
Got it. Okay. That makes sense.
And but as politics would have it, the minute the law passed and became law, we had 40 lawsuits against us to kill it.
Okay.
And the law basically said if any part of the groundwater code was found unjustified, that all of it would be thrown out.
Oh, wow.
And I always remember it always stuck with me. The mines had been part of the negotiation, and the minute the law was passed, they sued us. But anyway, none of the lawsuits worked, so the groundwater code became law.
Okay.
And the active management areas, which was called, there were four of them, and that's where the heaviest regulation occurred. Prescott, the Phoenix Active Management Area, the Pinal Active Management Area, and the Pima, basically Pima County, Tucson. It was called the Tucson Active Management Area.
Okay.
And each one of these would have a planning group that would put the law into place and would regulate groundwater use. You were given how much water you could pump. They put devices on all the pumps in all those areas.
On all the wells?
You know how much, all the wells, big wells. If it was a small well, you weren't covered in the law.
Okay.
But if it was a large well, it got a thing that would basically tell you how much water you're pumping. And they had to file, just like your tax report, every year they all had to file, whether you were city, mines, or agriculture, you had to file a report with the Department of Water Resources, tell them how much water you pumped.
Okay.
And every one of these eight groups that were using groundwater also had to, they were given a limit on how much water they could pump. And if they exceeded it, we had a legal department that would take them to court, and they had to pay a fine.
Okay.
And they also had goals. Tucson, Phoenix, and Prescott had a goal of basically safe yield, where the idea was that once the Central Arizona Project came in, these areas could get almost completely off of groundwater, that safe yield meaning whatever goes into the ground equals what is coming out of the ground.
Okay.
And of course, for years, these areas had been pumping way more water than they're than is going into the ground. But with the Central Arizona Project now, they could replace groundwater use with PAP water.
Okay.
And the only one that was different was the Pinal County Active Management Area, because it was all agriculture. And there's no way in the world they could ever reach safe yield.
Okay.
And the idea there, the goal became sustainability. Leave enough water for the cities that lie in Pinal County for their future growth. So, because they could never reach safe yield.
And it's interesting that Prescott was included as well. They must not have liked that, because they didn't have any CAP water.
No, but they're out of water.
Right. You bet they do.
But they were put on the list with the hopes that a active management office and a person regulating their groundwater use might help with their issue.
Okay.
And so, because there's a huge water problem in Prescott. There is also in Kingman, Flagstaff, Payson. They can't grow. They can't. But maybe the other in the back of a lot of minds was that maybe Prescott would get some supply of CAP water. They couldn't take it, but maybe they could trade it with somebody. in particular the Salt River Project.
Oh, okay.
Because what they're doing right now is the water for Prescott comes out of Chino Valley.
Right.
Chino Valley is in the watershed of the Salt River Project.
Exactly, and the Verde, and yeah.
And they own all the water rights on the Verde.
All right.
So at what point, there's a spring just downstream. You know, when you go to Seligman from Prescott, you go through that road, and there's a sign that says you're now crossing the Verde River, and you look down, it's dry as a bone. Well, there's a huge watershed there that the Verde starts on a spring downstream from that location.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's a big spring. But where does that water come from? It's probably coming from upstream somewhere.
A basin, you bet.
And Prescott has wells, and they're taking water out of there.
Uh-huh.
The Salt River Project watching everything they do.
Hmm.
And again, if all of a sudden that spring is pumping less water, guess what? Salt River Project will have Prescott in court over a lawsuit that you're taking our water.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So anyway, that's what, and they picked this was political positions. Each director of those offices were appointed by the director, and they served at the pleasure of the director.
Okay.
We had a director in Tucson, Pinal, Phoenix, and Prescott, and. I was not the first director when the law was passed, but as time went on, I was taken from my position, and I served as the Pinal AMA director for 1 year. And that's another story. Farmers hated being regulated, and I used to have a guy who called me every night telling me he was going to kill me.
Oh, my gosh.
Until I quit the phone, and he had no way of contacting me, and others would come in the office and tell if I set foot on their land, they'd shoot me, and I would tell them, well, it won't be me, it'll be the sheriff, and he'll shoot back.
Yeah.
But in general, I think we ran a pretty good office, but again...
What year was that, Frank?
That would have been 1983.
Okay.
And I served 1 year as a Pinal AMA director, and then I got a promotion to become the Phoenix AMA director. And everybody was being elevated. We were all stepstoning up the ladder of success, if you will.
Well, Frank, you must have known that if you're a director, you're at the, as you say, sort of at the pleasure of the entire department director, and that's a political appointee. That looks like you're kind of walking out on kind of shaky soil. Because now it's the political winds that are blowing that steer whether you have a job or not.
It was a big increase in salary.
That's helpful, but the risk is losing the job. Then what would you do? So,
Well, that was a good. You made a good point. Because I served as the Phoenix AMA director from 83 clear down to the late 1980s.
Okay, so it was a 10-year ride there.
Yeah, it was. I served with a lot of directors.
Okay.
And different governors, too.
Okay.
Until the late 1980s, a director came in and started firing everybody, and I got fired. But... I remember the conversation I had with the director was Betsy Rieke. She's an attorney. Became, the head of the Bureau of Reclamation in Washington, D.C. when Babbitt was Secretary of Interior. But she called me in. She had fired several other heads of that were political. And she said, I'm making one exception with you, she said. Because of your knowledge, I'm going to allow you to take a lesser position with lesser money because you also have a lot of years towards retirement.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I'm removing you from the AMA position and replacing you with somebody else, and if somebody in these other agencies will take you, I will not object to that, and you will. And by the way, as an engineer, high-paid engineer, and I knew all the people, so the deputy director immediately hired me, and I became a kind of a guru on the Colorado River, along the river, and would help the people who had not yet got contracts for CAP, Colorado River water, and I did a lot of work in the Yuma area.
Okay, and, so hang on, Frank. The deputy director of the Department of Water Resources?
Rehired me.
Got it. Okay. Good.
and I was able to stay on till I retired in 1998.
Okay.
And I had a job along the Colorado River. It was a drop in salary, but the bottom line was my retirement would be calculated based on my political position.
Oh, for your high salary.
Right. But it had to be done within a 10-year period, so I was nearing the 10-year period. So
got it.
I had enough years to retire. I was going to get the high retirement amount as though I were still the AMA director, so I decided to retire.
Okay. Now, in this time period from 81 to your retirement in 98, you're in your 40s into your 50s. Would have been 40 in 1982, and then 50 in 1992. But you've got some Grand Canyon hiking going on here. When did you kind of start turning your focus, your recreational pastime focus, into more hiking in Grand Canyon?
Well, the transition that occurred basically was I was doing less and less deer hunting or hunting, just plain hunting, as time went on. And CL had also left the Bureau of Reclamation and was working for FHA, Farmers Home Administration. And CL had gathered a group. I did a lot of hunting with CL, but CL was also changing. Like I mentioned before, we went from hunting with rifles to hunting with bow and arrows and hunting with pistols.
Okay.
Became less successful with the bow and arrow. Never killed anything with the bow and arrow, but it was fun.
Bow hunting. Let's talk about bow hunting for a minute, because I mean that's the people who are doing that. There, I mean, some of them are like taking baths in baking soda to take all the scent off their skin, and everything is scentless.
No. We were never that big. We just
okay.
We just had camouflage outfits and tried to sneak up on the game so we could get a shot.
Super hard. Super hard. You make a wrong noise and they're gone.
Exactly.
Wow.
We found that out. And I can't tell you exactly how it happened, but basically we also, DL was making buddies in the hiking arena.
Oh.
And I was converting with CL from hunting over to wilderness hiking.
Okay.
And then, of course, in there, CL became an avid Grand Canyon hiker. And I did, he brought me with him.
Okay.
And he had a whole set of friends that were also well into Grand Canyon hiking.
When was this? When did this transition happen?
Well, it would have been probably began around the late, right around the time, I would say in the 80s.
Okay, so the early mid 1983 kind of time, or
probably.
Okay.
Somewhere in there.
Okay.
And it's hard to tell because it occurred slowly.
Hmm.
And little by little we started, what vacation time we had, we were spending less time hunting and more time wilderness backpacking. And I mean, it wasn't just Grand Canyon. We did hiking in the Mazatzals.
Oh, the Mazatzals? Yeah.
Mazatzals, I was called Mazatzals. But we did a lot of hiking in there. One trip we took from Lurie River. We had to park cars in two different places.
Right.
We hiked across the Verde River over to the road to Payson.
Wow.
And there we did that in a day.
Wow.
And we had a car waiting for us at the other end.
Okay.
And then we had to drive all the way back and pick up our car at the Verde River.
Work your shuttle back out, yeah.
Right. And then we did several trips across the Mazatzal, across the top of the mountain range.
Okay.
The trail up on top. And we did a lot of in that entire the wilderness area that's in there, the Mazatzal wilderness. And we also, when I was working with the department, I went into New Mexico and did some hiking in the Gila wilderness.
Okay.
And we, I just, again, this transition was occurring where we were less interested in hunting and more interested. And then at the same time, CL was jumping in with both feet on the Grand Canyon. And he was gathering a group of his friends. And so we were putting together a team that would eventually be into the Grand Canyon. And then we all met Harvey.
Tell me about that. What year was that?
I probably the first time we met him would have been I'm going to guess at the early 90s.
Okay. And Harvey would have been long of tooth at that time.
Right. He was an old, in 1990s, he wasn't that old, I will say.
Okay.
He just died this year of 95, so he, what would that be, 20, 30 years earlier? So he'd have been in his 60s.
This is Harvey Butchart, B-U-T-C-H-A-R-T?
Right.
Yeah, I think that's the spelling. I'm trying to remember when he passed away.
He just passed away recently, a couple of years ago, I think.
Oh, maybe that's somebody else we're thinking of then.
Well, this is Harvey that wrote the book. The Grand Canyon, 5,000 miles or whatever miles he did in the canyon.
Okay.
So this is the Harvey, but he didn't die, and I'm terrible at this. I keep thinking it was just yesterday, and it turned out 10
years
ago.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
And if he was, I would put him at 60. When I first met him, he was giving a presentation, and I went to one of his presentations, which he would have been in his late 60s, early 70s, I think. So I don't know what year that would fall.
Okay.
And of course, we went to several of his presentations, and CL actually did had a close relationship with Harvey.
Right. He died in 2002. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I apologize.
No worries.
Too much. I do that a lot. I seem to think it was just yesterday.
Well, yeah, we do. It's part of our life as we get older. It was just a day, a few days. Last week, wasn't it? No, it was like 20 years ago.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
But Harvey had a very good relationship with CL.
Okay.
And it turned out that in the future, most of our hikes that we did, CL would first call Harvey.
Okay.
And Harvey had been there before us, and Harvey and CL were pretty close.
Okay.
I mean, every trip we took where there was no trail, CL would first call Harvey because Harvey had been there already.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he would get hints and so on, and then we would put together our group. But also know, CL... I was careful about which hikes I would agree to go on.
Okay.
Because CL was like Harvey. They could go anywhere. There was very little of the Grand Canyon that would stop them. And there were a lot of places in the Grand Canyon that would stop me.
Okay.
So I was careful which hikes I went on, but still, the hikes I went on were exciting enough. But there were others that, like, one of the things CL did that probably nobody else did, including Harvey. I don't know if Harvey did this or not, but CL would drop off the canyon and go down to the river where there's no trail, and he would carry a raft with him.
Yep.
And he would inflate the raft, a little one-person raft, and he would cross the Colorado River to the other side,
okay,
to a remote area where nobody had been. And then he would hike that area and come out somewhere where there's a trail.
All the while carrying his little pack raft.
Which was this little tiny raft.
Yeah.
And CL would do a lot of that. And
this was in the 1980s or 1990s? When was he doing that?
Oh, CL was, it would have been through probably into 2000. Don't forget, CL was 10 years older than I am, but he was like Harvey.
Okay.
He had the physical condition of an 18-year-old. He ran 50-mile marathons in the mountains when he was in his 80s.
Wow.
And I would go as far to say he probably was one of the few human beings in the world that was doing that.
Okay.
I mean, age did not bother CL at all.
Nice.
And he just died, I believe, last year.
Okay.
He finally died he got Lou Gehrig's disease.
Oh, wow.
And but CL was amazing. CL was the leader of this pack, and we had like five or six guys, and CL would work out a plan. Sometimes, like I said, there were some hikes that I said no, I better not. And but there were other groups out there that were doing Grand Canyon hiking that I would go with also.
Okay.
Like when I worked for the state of Arizona, we did the North Bass Trail.
Okay.
That was all. There's an interesting story.
Yeah, tell me about that.
There was a group from DWR. One of the engineers there came to me and said, "We're putting together a group to do the North Bass." I said, "Well, count me in."
Okay.
And it was he was bringing his wife. And he had one of the other engineers was going, I was going, and this guy who was the head of a water company on the west side was going to go. Well, his wife had just had a baby about a month ago, and instead of him going, she decided to use the permit. The permit was for five people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we all were worried to death, here's a lady who just had a baby.
Right.
But it was amazing. We couldn't keep up with her. She was
nice.
In fantastic condition. And we went down the North Bass.
Okay.
And
do you remember roughly what year this would have been, roughly?
It would have probably been in the 90s, sometime in the 1990s.
Early 90s, mid-90s, late 90s?
Yeah, earlier 90s.
Okay. And so that trail probably was pretty brushed over at that time.
Oh, there wasn't much of a trail. It's a lot of bushwhacking.
Okay.
But we actually didn't go all the way to the river.
Okay.
What we did is we set up a camp. You know where where the Bass Camp is?
Yes, where
the Bass Trail?
In Shinamoo Creek there.
Right, that's where we camped.
Okay.
And we decided, because there was so much to see there at Shinamoo Creek,
yeah,
you know, that we decided to just spend our time there and not go all the way to the river.
Okay.
So we stayed there and explored all that country and fantastic sights. And then we came back up to the car, and at a later date, there were three of us. This was after I had left the department that went up on top of the Powell Plateau.
Okay.
And we that was an interesting trip. The, There's Indian ruins at every corner up there.
Yeah.
The prehistoric Indians. I also was impressed in the way the if you look around, it makes you believe that's the way Arizona was before the lumber companies came in. But you have these great big trees with distance apart from the next tree. But if you go into the forest today, you can't even walk through forest because of all the little trees that are in there.
It's very thick,
But what impressed me was you had these great big pine trees, and there was distance between them and the next tree. Because the young trees wouldn't get started within the shade of the bigger trees.
Right. Yeah.
And nobody had ever done any lumbering on the Powell Plateau.
Right.
And it was a big, beautiful area. And then that was one trip we took up, and we spent several days on
top
of it.
Did you stay at the cabin, or did you stay up on the plateau there?
No, we stayed on the plateau.
Okay.
No, the cabin, we visited the cabin, but I wouldn't have, this was, no, we brought tents and all kinds of equipment to stay on the ground.
Did you like set up a base camp there and then walk out from your base camp?
That's what we did.
Nice.
And I remember going to the point where, you have that painting by Moran.
Mm, uh-huh.
I went to that point and looked over, and again, it was a great trip. That was one of the trips. That was not a CL trip. That was some friends of mine decided to go.
Okay.
And then a lot of times, a bunch of us, again, we didn't always, like I said, CL had a couple of friends that were like Harvey and like him. There weren't many cliffs that would stop them.
Okay.
I had my limits. Another trip I took, to give you an example, CL one time went down the real scary trip. What do they call it? It's on the west side. It's a very famous trail.
Gosh, let's see. On the west side. It's
on the North Rim.
Okay, North Rim, and it's west of Bass?
It's west of the center, the lodge and all that.
So west of Deer Creek, west of Thunder River, west of Toro Weep, Kanab, west of Whitmore, Separation. I'm just moving.
I'm sorry, I screwed up. I meant east of there.
East, okay.
Nankoweap.
Got it, okay, thank you.
Okay, well, CL did Nankoweap.
Okay.
Went down to the creek there, Nankoweap Creek.
Yep.
And continued down to the Colorado River, not on the one everybody takes, but he bushwhacked across to come on the other side of the little Colorado River. He then crossed the Colorado to the other side and came up that trail on the south rim.
Came up the Tanner then?
Yeah, he came from where the Little Colorado enters the Colorado.
So did he go up the Little Colorado to the Blue Springs, or did he go down the Beamer to the Tanner and out that way?
Down to the Tanner and up that way.
Okay.
But he also went to the Sipau. He went down to the Sipau and visited it on the Little Colorado.
Okay.
He was Harvey Bouchard, except he was younger than Harvey.
Okay.
And I did the Nankoweap one year with a group from Colorado that came down, and I went down with them, and we went down to the Nankoweap ruins.
Okay.
And spent a couple of days there. It's interesting, the one thing I found is once you get down to the creek, every tributary there has Native American ruins in there. There's pottery all over the ground. It's a mecca of where the Indians once lived.
Yes, yeah.
And, but And then an ankle leap, you got to watch your steps, no doubt. But and then probably the most, this was a CL trip that he had arranged, and I went with him. And, of course, he checked with Harvey. This was a Harvey trek.
Okay.
You know where Indian Hollow is?
Yes.
Well, that creek right there where Indian Hollow is, we followed it all the way down to Kanab Creek.
Okay.
And there we followed Kanab Creek to the Colorado, followed along the Colorado River till we got to where that real narrow part of the canyon is.
Back to Deer Creek?
Deer Creek. We went to Deer Creek. We followed up Deer Creek and went back up to our car, which was at Indian Hollow.
Right.
It was, we made that, that was one of Harvey's trips.
Nice.
And it took us about 4 days to do that.
Okay. That's a good speed.
That is. And we needed ropes, by the way. But one of the things interesting we did was, this was early, not real early, but cell phones, none of us had cell phones or anything. And the one thing, we only had one rope with us. So if you use the rope to pull yourself down and you pull the rope behind you and you found a cliff below you that you couldn't handle without the rope,
right?
Then you were stuck between two cliffs and could go nowhere. And we didn't have cell phones in those days. So
right.
We'd be stuck in the canyon. So what we did was we would lower the rest of us, which were humans, with rope, and then CL would climb back up without a rope. If he could do that, then we'd go on to the next cliff.
Okay.
And we always, with CL with us, we'd never be lost.
Got it.
CL could climb straight up the cliff, and as long as he could, then we could pull the rope behind us. We knew we could get out.
Okay.
And another interesting thing, Willie Samuel, I mentioned to him,
yes,
came from Denver, and he brought a buddy of his with him. And we all warned, all of us said, don't bring somebody into the canyon that doesn't know what he's doing, because
yeah,
it just hinders the rest of us.
Yeah.
Well, Willie made the mistake. The guy was in very good shape.
Okay.
That wasn't the issue, but the issue were the cliffs.
Okay.
And this guy freaked out on us.
Oh.
And he said, I can't continue. And we said, well, it's too late. I said, we told him, you can stay here. We'll give you enough food and water to sustain you for a week. And then when it's going to take us 4 or 5 days to get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll call the Forest Service. They'll come in to rescue you, but they're going to charge you thousands of dollars for the rescue.
Yeah.
And if you want, that's what we'll do, or you can continue with us. He said, tell my wife I loved her, I remember him saying, and he quit talking. And but Willie took very good care of him. Willie would, in fact, would put himself between the cliffs and this guy, and he took very good care of him until we finally made it to the top. And he finished it. And I remember I have a picture of him kissing the ground when we reached the car.
Good for Willie. That's awesome.
Yeah, because Willie said he would never do that again, which is, we warned everybody because the canyon is not for everybody.
Right, right.
Like, I don't know if you remember the article that was written by a lady who did the ankle leap. She didn't finish it. She was halfway through there and decided to go back because it was too scary.
Okay.
And there's a lot of people who think hiking is just hiking until they get into the canyon and the cliffs that they encounter.
Right.
And I had my limits. And then the other one we did, CL was going to drop off. You probably know where Ghost Rock is.
Yes.
Well, CL was going to, he had never seen Ghost Rock, so
okay.
I told him, I would join you up to Ghost Rock.
Okay.
And then CL would, right for where Ghost Rock is, he would go straight down off a cliff there, down to the Colorado River.
Oh, he was going to take that route that Arnie Richards and Dave Mortensen pioneered. Right.
That's correct.
Right.
That's correct. That's what he did.
Okay.
But I wouldn't. But I said, I do want to see Ghost Rock. So I went with him down to Ghost Rock.
Okay.
We spent the night at Ghost Rock, and then we went to the spring that's there.
Yep.
There's a spring about west of
Ghost
Rock.
Just a little bit, yep.
And we went, we hiked there from Ghost Rock to the spring.
Mm-hmm.
I took a lot of pictures of the spring.
Cool.
And then we went back to Ghost Rock, spent the night. And I got a picture of the, there were two others with CL, and I took a picture of them as they left towards that trail.
Oh, they were going down the Cranberry Canyon route.
I don't know what it was, but it was directly south of Wills Rock.
Yeah.
And they went down that way and would come mm-hmm. up Deer Creek and back
right.
to the car.
And you would pick them up when they came across the Thunder River Trail.
Well, they drove their own cars. I drove my car.
Oh, okay.
On that trip. So they ended up heading towards that trip, and I hiked back up to my car and went back to Phoenix.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Now, another CL trip that I thought was worthwhile. We always wanted, all of us wanted to go to, what's it called, Keyhole Natural Bridge.
Okay.
And the first time CL attempted it, he went up to Havasu and into that, there's a big canyon there on the other side of Havasu, goes all the way to the Colorado. And he hiked down to the river, came back up, and tried to reach Keyhole from there. But he found out it was a major, major undertaking. That was a big, wide canyon. And he had to cut that trip short and went back to Havasu. I remember him calling me and said, you know what, can you pick us up at the Havasu parking lot? And
okay.
I did.
Okay.
So that was one of CL's trips that didn't work.
Okay.
Because of the distance. It was large distance in there. Well,
yeah, so you have to pass Sinyala and Matt Katamiba and Olo to get to the Keyhole, to get to 140 Mile. And that's a lot of rough country over the Esplanade and not a lot of water, depending on the time of the year.
Exactly. You're 100% right. The next attempt, I decided to go with him.
Okay.
And we had about, there was about five of us.
Okay.
Maybe six of us. And CL worked for FHA, and we decided to go through the Indian lands to get to a Keyhole.
Okay.
And CL had a loan out with the Hualapai tribe. And he was also working with the Havasupai. So CL got us a permit.
Okay.
And we decided to go to Keyhole through the reservation.
Okay.
Which, if you look at the map, there used to be a trail across the Great Thumb Mesa.
Yes.
That went down from there.
The deer trail.
Well,
yeah.
Right. But you're still talking... huge distances of hiking to get to Keyhole, no matter where you... Keyhole is... you can't get to it from the river, and the only way you can get to it is from the top. And so it was it was a challenge. And so what we did is we set up a base camp in the flatlands. We parked our cars... I think part of the Indians would not allow any vehicles onto their land, so we had to park it where the trail began and towards Great Thumb Mesa.
Okay.
And then we set up a base camp somewhere at the base of Great Thumb Mesa. And then what we did is, rather than go down the Great Thumb Mesa where the trail once existed, doesn't today, we bushwhacked from the throat of Great Thumb Mesa, and we just jumped off the cliff and went straight down.
Okay.
Which saved us miles.
Yes.
And we were ripped to shreds with brush.
Oh.
But I remember I lost my wristwatch.
Oh my gosh.
It was ripped off my hand in the brush, and I didn't even know it. But CL found it, but that's another story.
Oh my gosh.
But he wouldn't tell me. And finally, after that trip, we were eating at a restaurant. We always ate at El Charro in Flagstaff there.
Oh, cool.
And we were eating there, and he put my wristwatch on the gal who was serving us. And when she came, I looked at it, and I said, boy, that's an interesting watch you have. That was the one I thought I had lost in the canyon. And CL had picked it up and thought he'd do a joke.
That's funny.
Anyway, we went all the way down, and it was a tough hike. There was no trail. We were bushwhacking. And finally, we got to that creek that flows into Keyhole.
140 miles, yeah.
And we set up camp upstream in that creek. There was water in that creek, by the way.
Okay.
So we had water. But we set up our tents in a camp just upstream of where Keyhole is.
Okay.
And it took most of the day once we started that we bushwhacked and got all the way into that stream and camped there. And the next morning we went down to Keyhole, which is a spectacular sight.
Yeah.
And we spent the whole day exploring the area. And in fact, there was a pile of rocks, and in there were all the people who had seen Keyhole and signed their names on a piece of paper and put it inside the pile of rocks.
And there's there should have been a little container there.
There was.
Handmade, possibly by Pat Riley.
I don't know. I don't know the history of who did what.
Okay.
There was a container, and inside the container was a piece of paper, and all of us signed our names to the paper.
Nice.
And put it back in there and piled the rocks over it.
Nice.
And then we decided to go back. Oh, I think we spent 2 days there. And then decided to go back. Another interesting thing, there's a spring there. A spring below Great Thumb Mesa.
Okay, yes.
And it's hard to make that trek because no matter how you get to Keyhole, you need water.
Yes.
And that spring was in the old days, but there was also wild horses all through the area.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, we saw some.
Okay.
But they're all over the area. But then what we decided to do, CL, of course, was going to go back to where we came down. I said, no way. That's just too rough.
Hmm.
I said, I'm going to go back where they once had a trail.
Yeah, the Tahuta Point route. Sure.
That's correct. And me and this other guy said, he agreed with me. And, of course, the CL followers went up with CL, which was quicker. And we said we would take 2 days to get back to the base camp.
Okay.
We would because it was several miles longer to go by that trail.
Yeah, yeah.
But CL was going to take the shortcut, be there at the camp. So me and this other guy took that trail. Since it was going to be a two-day trip, we had to get water at the spring.
Okay.
When we got to the spring, the horses had crapped in the water. But we had to drink it. We had no choice.
Yep.
Boiled the water, and we filled our canteens. And we went up that trail. And there's a gate up on near the top of Great Thumb.
Yes, there is.
Where you see the fence is gone, but the gate is still there, where that used to be the way they used to come down in the old days.
Was there a horse skull on that gate?
It's what now?
Was there a horse skull on that gate?
No, I don't remember. I just remember it was just a gate by itself.
All right.
And there was not much fence around it. It was just the only thing they didn't tear down was the gate.
Yeah.
And it was, but anyway, we went passed up on top of the Great Thumb, spent the night there, and then the next day we hiked towards the car. And, of course, Indian ruins all over the place. The prehistoric Indians were all over the Great Thumb.
Yeah.
Went back to the group. They had been there a day already at base camp, and we came back.
Cool.
And that was one of our better trips.
Nice. You know what, Frank?
And,
we've been visiting now for a little over an hour. Maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this interview series, and we will pick this up again with your recounting more of your Grand Canyon adventures.
That sounds good. I'll talk to you tomorrow if you want to do it.
Well, hang on a second. We'll is there anything in the material we've just covered, which is quite a lot, that I didn't ask you that you wanted to bring in to this section?
No, I think we've covered the main issues, but there is, we did a lot of Grand Canyon hiking, and I've left out a couple of other hikes that we did.
Good, let's pick that up. We'll pick that up next time. That sounds good.
Okay, that sounds
good.
And
so with that, this will conclude part four of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Frank Barrios. Today is January 31st, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Frank, thank you so very much.
Thank you.